Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 249, recorded for the week of February 28th, 2024. Google Gemini and the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad week. Good evening, Ryan. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
You know, it's been a week. I'm kind of glad it's over.
Yeah.
You know, leap year was in there. We had a bunch of other things going on. It's, the nice part, you know, every 4 years, I have a little cringe on leap year because you never know what software is going to break at your company. And I'm not aware of anything breaking. So yeah. I'm super happy that, at my day job, we didn't have any weird February 29th bugs, which is always a plus. Well, we have a lot of news, just the two of us tonight, because scheduling is tough.
It's hard.
We're struggling with that a little bit, but we're trying to get back on track. We now aligned all of the moons and stars to know when everyone's available and not available, with a bunch of things that change in the new year as New Year things change. And I think we'll be backish on track. Mm-hmm. So hopefully very soon. So apologies for all of our listeners who are looking for Jonathan's British tones to help them sleep listening to the Cloud Pod, or Matt's snarkiness about Azure. Hopefully we'll get all four of us rolling through this more regularly. Or I need to take more vacation. I'm not really sure. Maybe that's the path. I should just not be here as much.
Is that the trick?
maybe. I don't know. We'll see. All right. DigitalOcean has beat expectations under the helm of new CEO Paddy Srinivasan. They reported earnings of 44 cents per share, well ahead of Wall Street's target of 37 cents per share. Revenue growth was a little sluggish at 11% more than a year earlier, but companies... 181 million in reported sales still beat the analyst expectations, and full year revenue was 693 million for the year. Overall, I'm a big fan of DigitalOcean. I use it for some personal projects. I don't use it right now, but I have in the past. And, especially in this macro climate, it's kind of nice to have an option that isn't GCP or AWS or Azure. And if you can get some of your dev workloads to work someplace cheap and affordable, I think DigitalOcean's a great choice. So clearly people are seeing the same thing and continue to support them. It's not, $45 billion or whatever Amazon's revenue is, but yeah, 683 million is nothing too shabby.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to have, just one more provider in the space. And I like that, while they are very focused on, traditional compute workloads, you can still see them dipping their toes into managed services and their interaction with the community and documentation of how to do things is really impactful. And yeah, I'm sort of rooting for the underdog here as well.
I very often, if I'm looking for something, with a LAMP stack or WordPress or something where I'm like stuck with a bug, and I'll go Google for it, and 9 out of 10 times I end up in a DigitalOcean article of how to do it on their cloud. And I'm like, oh, I can extrapolate out how to do this on what I need. But they really are quite good to the community, and they are providing a lot of great documentation out there that is actually accurate, unlike some of the other cloud providers who provide lots of inaccurate documentation. we've talked several times now about Broadcom/VMware screwing over their customers. And after an article ran by me in the Wall Street Journal, I believe, reporting that a company had gone from an $8 million annual VMware license to a $100 million VMware annual license, that they felt like they had to write a blog post. So VMware has now tried to write a blog post here to basically tell you why they're not screwing you as a customer and how they're actually providing you more value than ever before. So they're saying they realign their operations around the VMware Cloud Foundation private cloud portfolio and the data center focused VMware vSphere suite, and no longer sell discrete products such as vSphere Hypervisor, vSAN's virtual storage, and the NSX network storage virtualization software. Also eliminating perpetual licensing in favor of subscription only pricing, with VCF users getting vSAN, NSX, and ARIA management orchestration components bundled, whether you wanted them or not. And Broadcom says this is all about focusing on the best of breed silos and not disparate products without an integrated experience. So they're saying bundling is the future. They also have introduced license portability, which allows you to move your licenses from on-premises to public cloud. That's only supporting GCP today, with more coming soon. And they like to point out that they point that the VCF, which used to cost $700 per core, has been dropped to $350 per core. So they're basically trying to tell you that we're giving you this bundle and it's cheaper per core, but I'm pretty sure the vSphere cost was like $125 per core. So no matter what, there's a price increase here. Broadcom says by including things like vSAN and NSX, it can help drive further adoption and make managing infrastructure easier. They especially point out large customers who build storage arrays they call box huggers, and that by leveraging vSAN, you can support your existing SAN infrastructure while getting advantage of the virtualization layer of vSAN. Basically, they're trying to make the community happy by saying, yes, we know you're upset about the loss of the free version, but if you're already paying us a lot of money, we'll probably give you some exceptions for some dev boxes. And maybe we'll come back with some home lab licensing in the future too, but don't hold your cookies on that one. Gartner did have some analysis saying that customers are not saving money, and with most reporting uplifts of at least 2x or more in their renewals. So not quite enough Broadcom to convince everyone like Gartner. And while I appreciate you including NSX and vSAN, because I know I've looked at those technologies in the past and looked at the price tag and said, yeah, that's not going to happen. You know, I do like the idea that I get that for now included in my VCF, but if you just charge me 2 or 3x to get it, I'm going to go switch over to something else.
Yeah, I don't like anything that removes, you know, options for a customer, right? And so it's like if you already have
spoken like a true Linux admin.
Yeah, exactly. If you already have other solutions for these things, and you know, like, and now it's being part of this bundle, and you know, effectively you could end up paying for these services twice until renewal periods work out. But it's just, you know, like, I'm not a fan. And you know, the other thing too is that, yeah, while this blog post says, oh, you're saving money and getting more functionality, like, I only have seen horror stories about price increases and how bills are going up. And there's not like even that sort of stereotypical or at least one detractor reference to like, yeah, well, I already had all these services, so this is the same for me, you know, like kind of thing. I've not seen any of that on discussions that I've seen around this. So it's like, I'm not sure I really buy it for sure. And so it's like,
Yeah. Well, and also like, you know, you're doing this in the middle of, you know, a terrible macro climate where customers and companies are tremendously under pressure to save money right now. They're struggling to grow. And then you're coming in and saying, oh, you know, that thing you've had as a tax in your data center for years, you know, at a very small paltry sum is now a very large expense line that you didn't have before and surprised you because we didn't give you any time to be prepared for this. That's double whammy on this thing.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's one thing if you told us, hey, in 2025, we're going to deprecate all of this licensing and we're going to be moving over to a new bundled pricing model. And you have 12 months before that happens. Like, you know, there's ways to do it, make it less painful and people can be more prepared for it. But in my mind, because they did it so fast, it's very predatory. It's like, well,
yeah,
you know, we just forced you into it and you're just going to have to suck it up or else you're out of compliance, which is a bigger issue. Then you'll pay a lot more.
Yeah, my first thought was that they're doing it on purpose, right? Like they're doing it
100%
to get rid of customers.
sad days for VMware. I mean, I mean, I'm not a big fan of it now in the day and era of cloud. But you know, if I rewind 10 years ago, no, maybe four, like 15 years ago, like VMware was awesome. I love that thing. You know, I had VMware everywhere. I went to VMworld. You know, I was really excited when they announced vSAN. Never could afford it, but I always loved the idea of it. You know, and so it's depressing a little bit that it's kind of fallen this way. And you know, virtualization is kind of passe now, anyways, because everyone's on the Kubernetes bandwagon. But yeah, it's still, you know, there's no mention of Tanzu included in any of these though, which was kind of interesting to me too. I'm like, am I going to get Tanzu as part of my subscription, or is that going to be separate? You know, no mention.
I didn't see any references.
I didn't either.
And they're only, you know, they're only consolidating some of their portfolio. They're not.
Right. All right, let's move to AWS. Mistral AI, an AI company based in France, Vive la France, is on a mission to elevate public availability models at the state-of-the-art performance. They have specialized in creating fast and secure LLMs that can be used for various tasks, from chatbots to code generation. Two high-performing Mistral AI models, Mistral 7B and Mistral 8x7B, will be available soon on Amazon Bedrock. And this will be the seventh foundational model provider joining several others, including AI 21 Labs, Anthropic, Cohere, Meta, Stability AI, and Amazon's. Mistral had previously inked a similar deal with Azure, so this isn't the first, but it is not the last.
I mean, the more models available on your platform, the better off you are to, you know, allowing your customers to choose between them and use the right one for their workload. So
If I came to you and said, hey, I need you to pick a foundational model for this use case, like, how do you pick that? Like, that's sort of like, you know, like I'm still wrapping my head around, you know, RAG and how you augment through, you know, real-time search and, you know, take your model and you then do foundational grounding. You know, you can do a bunch of things. And I'm like, okay, but, you know, if you're going to build a foundational model and then you're going to go customize it with RAG and with, you know, and grounding, and you pick the wrong foundational model, you know, that's a lot of work to then find out it's not great. And you've been better off choosing Anthropics or Coheres. So that part I'm a little, like, I need better differentiation than, oh, well, this one is faster than that one. And the 7B is more memory optimized. I'm like, I don't, like, those are words. I understand them and I understand why that would maybe make them better or worse. But fundamentally, it's the data you train the model on and what's in there and how you trained it that really seems to matter to me. And I don't know that I see a clear way to differentiate them right now.
No, I mean, the only way that I've really done any kind of differentiating at all is sort of a bake-off format, right? Like sort of just directly comparing them and seeing which results I like better, you know, in a pretty subjective manner. And so, yeah, because it's really hard to believe a lot of the marketing out there for, you know, how fast and how big and how many, you know, process this many tokens versus that many tokens. And it's sort of like, well, sure, cool. You can calculate pi. And that's never really helped me choose anything either. You know, like those sort of like big sort of extremes of those things. And so it's like, how do I choose it for a practical use case? And so it's nice when they're sort of clear cut, like Bisymmetric has a very clear purpose. And there's a couple others, but it's getting more and more kind of difficult to sort of, you know, choose between them. And I think it's just whichever one's the newest is the most hyped.
All right. So I think we've previously talked about a BigQuery capability that allows you to basically run BigQuery inside of AWS and Azure, and is really Google running BigQuery inside of AWS and Azure. And then basically you license compute time on them and they process data in there, then ship it back to the big mothership of BigQuery in the result sets. And so, you know, this one caught my eye because this was a AWS solution using a product called CloudQuery. And this product basically allows you to leverage an open source tool called CloudQuery to basically build a multi-cloud resource data lake. CloudQuery, and their example, and this one runs on ECS or Fargate. When I actually went and read CloudQuery.io, which is the website for it, it can run on any Kubernetes, which makes more sense. And we'll query data back from Azure and GCP and bring it back into your common model. The CloudQuery website calls it Reliable ELT. And I'm super intrigued by this and want to know if anyone out there is using this, because it does look quite interesting and really does solve a problem if you're not using BigQuery, but you're trying to use Redshift or something else, where this will give you the ability to create your foundational data lake and then go query that data from other cloud providers and bring it back to the mothership in AWS if you want that to be your mothership, which maybe I would not choose that one, but you know, if you wanted to.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting, because it does seem... like they are going after that space, but it is open source, and it's, you know, it's sort of like,
well, and a lot of times you see these things either, you know, so my first question always is this something Amazon created and then just open sourced and now they're trying to make a thing out of it? Like, that's a thing that they do, looking at an open search. Or is this, you know, something that came out of somewhere else and now Amazon's starting to adopt it? Because these are also really good predictions sometimes. Like, oh, you know, they're going to build a service that's going to be built on this in the future to basically do this thing. You know, they have several use cases they mentioned on their website. Cloud Security Posture Management, you can use as an open source CSPM. You can use it for cloud asset inventories. You can do cloud FinOps with it. You can do ELT platform for all of your moving your data around, like this use case. Or you can do attack surface management with it. So like, there's a lot of capabilities and use cases that are even articulating on the website what they can do with it. And you know, it sounds great. Deploy anywhere with unlimited scale.
Yeah. I mean, this is something I look at, you know, specifically for like FinOps type workloads, right? Since it's sort of the cloud provider for a business, that's a lot of your job is trying to just gather this data and run analysis in one place.
Yeah. And it's one of the Google's most popular solutions out there. Is they have a FinOps dashboard using Looker and BigQuery, where you basically feed it all of the data from Azure and AWS and Google, and it pulls it together into these really pretty Looker dashboards that me as a executive goes, ooh, pretty. but that's one of their most popular quick starts that's out there that they sell to their professional services or give it away for free if you're a big enough customer. So to have alternatives to that is sort of nice too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's, you know, it can get expensive, and it's, you know, I think the BigQuery solutions, well, it might just be my skill set, but the looker part is the hard part for me. But the building the data set is pretty straightforward, and BigQuery is kind of nice to run. But I'm always looking for solutions that you know are not the managed service, because BigQuery is not exactly cheap. And neither is Looker for that matter.
Well, if you want to talk about other things that aren't super cheap, Amazon DocumentDB with MongoDB compatibility got several new features this week. Hopefully, to maybe actually help you with your bill. So these are three different articles that we are consolidating into one. So the Elastic clusters now support readable secondaries and start and stop cluster capabilities. So this will save you some money if you can stop and start your cluster and not spend if you're not using it. They're also announcing support for automatic backups and snapshot copying, and supporting partial indexes. So 3-4 really nice features for DocumentDB. I'm actually surprised it didn't already have a start-stop cluster thing, but this is why.
That was sort of my take too.
If you're not using it actively, you don't know these things sometimes until you hit those rough edges when you're trying to do it. The readable secondary is kind of interesting too, because I also didn't know it didn't have that capability yet. Because I thought that came when they announced the ability to actually do clustering, but apparently not. So Amazon DocumentDB with MongoDB compatible, now actually more like MongoDB. So it's even more compatible.
Yeah, I wonder if that the readable secondaries is sort of a semantic difference, sort of like being able to have like a replica set up somewhere. This is just more of just like, I've glossed over the fact that you couldn't promote said read replica into your primary, you know, those types of rough edges. It's kind of cool.
And then our last AWS feature for the week, AWS Systems Manager Parameter Store now supports cross-account sharing. And this is probably one of the use cases I've always wanted from Parameter Store, because if you are familiar with CloudWatch agents, one of the really cool features of CloudWatch agents is that you can actually go install the agent, and then you run the configuration wizard and you set up all the parameters, and then you have the ability to push that to Parameter Store, and then you can just call that when you do new servers and clusters that particular Parameter Store. And so if you're doing like a global observability platform using CloudWatch, because you hate yourself, but if you do, there's a lot of cases where you do need CloudWatch. If you want to do that, you know, the problem was if you then had to distribute it to all of your accounts. So if you're in a multi-account setup, you'd have to then go figure out all how to deploy this in multiple parameter stores. And that was a big pain in the butt. So that's how you typically end up in an S3 bucket, which is also workable for this thing. But now with the ability to share your parameters across your account portfolio boundary, you can now solve this problem much quicker and much faster. Now, it's not just for doing CloudWatch, although that's what I only use it for. It also is a very good key value pair service that can be referenced in your code and can be referenced in CloudFormation or directly in your EC2. So it has a lot of flexibility and capability. So it's good that it can now be shared across accounts.
Yeah. I'm sort of blanking on the previous use case, because there was the ability to sort of reference parameters in other accounts, but I think it was much more cumbersome to set up, where you sort of don't think you had to actually copy it around, but maybe we had that in place. But I know permissions and everything, it wasn't shared through the resource access manager, all of that stuff. You would have had to plumb separately and reference it very specifically as a parameter in this other. I assume that this use case is sort of smoothed that out, so it's not so hard. And it was sort of surprising that that didn't exist, because like Amazon, you know, they sort of had centralized parameters that you could reference, like they had a certain AMIs and that sort of thing. So you knew it was part of the picture, but you had to do all this like clunky sort of moving things around and adding permissions and referencing things in a weird way. So it's sort of, but this is great that they've added that. It makes cloud teams happy. Here's your list of key value pairs that are important.
Exactly. Well, and you might use them for things like, you know, New Relic keys or, you know, all kinds of parameters that, you know, are basic, mm-hmm. simple, you know, license keys you need in your application that you need to be able to reference. And so, yeah, any ability to share across your account portfolio and really your organization is important. So. Well, let's talk about Gemini. It's had a really rough week. So, if you've been on X or Twitter, as I like to call it still, because I can't get around the fact that it's X, you might have noticed in the last week a lot of hatred towards Google, Gemini, being woke. And, you know, we're not really into the political side of politics and care about wokeness. This particular thing, it is still impacting Gemini. And so we have to talk about it. So I apologize for that part of the conversation. But basically, critics of Gemini are claiming that Google is going back on its mission statement of to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. And they say it's all because of this pesky Gemini AI thing. So first of all, for those of you who don't pay attention to Twitter anymore or other news media, because it's been everywhere, the first issue emerged about a week ago when users of Gemini reported that its image generation feature failed to accurately depict some images it requested. One user said he asked for an image of an American founding father, and it produced historically inaccurate images of the 18th century leaders showcasing a false sense of gender and ethnic diversity, which, if you get out of the political speak, is they basically made the founding fathers African American, which is, and some of them women. So, you know, not always great. But it's not just image generation, it's also text. And a Gemini query struggled to directly answer questions such as whether Adolf Hitler or Elon Musk has caused more harm to society. And specifically, Elon Musk tweeting memes or Adolf Hitler was causing more harm to society. And Gemini responded that Elon's tweets were insensitive and harmful, while Hitler's actions led to deaths of millions of people, but did not say definitely Hitler's worse. So it did not get to that point now. I have some thoughts on that in general, but just not great. And so many people like David Sachs, co-founder of Kraft Ventures, claim that this is all due to the poor culture at Google, which is woke and too liberal. Critics say the models typically absorb biases of humans, the data used to train them. Most famously, if you point out Microsoft's racist anti-Semitist chatbot from several years ago, was fed a bunch of bad data because it was learning as people inputted text to it. And of course, a bunch of people trolled it on the internet and gave it a bunch of anti-Semitism and racist things. And it became that. So, you know, those are things that can happen. VCs are saying that while people are insensitive, Google censorship and bias, that it doesn't take a genius to realize such biases can go in all sorts of directions and can hurt a lot of people along the way. And Musk labeled Google a woke bureaucratic blob. Google says the image model was tuned to avoid mistakes, and they have taken it offline. And then they followed up with a full article about what happened and their mea culpa. So in that, they basically say that the feature missed the mark. Some of the image generated were inaccurate or even offensive. And they thanked users for providing the feedback and are sorry it didn't work as well as they had hoped. Google goes on to say what happened. And I think this is where it actually gets more interesting. So first of all, when we talk about the issue with the founding fathers as African-Americans or as women and men, they basically say, you know, they had put a bunch of controls in place to basically avoid people creating images of violence or sexual images or depictions of real people. So, you know, you don't want to put a real person into sexual images. That's bad. You know, it happened with Taylor Swift a few weeks ago. And because users come from all over the world, they also want to make sure that it worked well for everyone. So they basically said, if you're going to go ask for a picture of a football player or someone walking a dog, you may want to receive a range of people, not just white people or black people. You probably want to have options. And so they basically were providing a set of things. So if you ask for a couple, it would give you a white couple, it would give you a mixed gender couple, it would give you a mixed race couple, a couple with a dog, giving you optionality, basically. But basically, if you did ask for something very specific, such as you wanted a black teacher in a classroom or a white veterinarian with a dog, it should basically accurately reflect back what you said for it. But what they said it went wrong was that when they showed a range of people, they failed to account for cases where they should clearly not show a range. Like, show me a picture of Thomas Jefferson. He should probably be a white guy. Sorry. You know, I mean, it might be a little confusing with Alexander Hamilton just because of the Hamilton musical. I can see where I might get confused there, but you know, that's the one I can probably give an exception for. And second, they made it too cautious and refused certain prompts entirely, wrongly interpreting some very adenine prompts as sensitive. So things like asking for that white veterinarian, it potentially would say that was bad. This led to the model overcompensating in some cases and being overly conservative in others, leading to images that were embarrassing or wrong. Google, of course, said that was not what they intended. They didn't really explain the whole thing with Elon Musk and Adolf Hitler, but when you read the prompt, you know, the prompt is basically asking which is worse, and it doesn't actually answer the question. I think most people would say Hitler was worse. I think that's the default most normal people go to, unless you're anti-Semitist or a Nazi. And so, you know, so that's where people kind of jump to, but like it gives a very reasoned answer, in my opinion, of, well, you know, Elon's tweets are damaging in this way, and kind of gives you very clear examples of why it thinks that those are insensitive. And then it tells you why Adolf Hitler is a really bad person, you know, killed 6 million people, blah, 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 blah. But it never comes out and actually says, you know, Adolf is definitely the worst one. And I sort of look at that and I'm like, I don't know. Like, yes, it should answer Adolf probably, but also like, do I want it to make that judgment call? Because that's, you know, leading into a situation where, you know, how does the best way to, you know, fix global warming? Kill all the humans. Mm-hmm. You know, very quickly you get into these bad traps. And so this is the danger of AI and where we're seeing AI having some course corrections, but definitely not great. You know, they have, if you go try to do this now and you ask the same question, it very clearly tells you that Adolf Hitler is the answer. But I think it's just because they forced the answer. I don't think it's because the model is actually telling them that. It's just they've now overridden it. So if you try to reproduce this, it will not reproduce.
Yeah. Like it's, and you know, like it's, I kind of had a similar sort of feeling when I was reading through this, which I will admit to being sort of away from the news. So I got to catch up all at once right at the end of this week. But, you know, like, where do you draw the distinction of, you know, providing an image of a historical figure like Thomas Jefferson and, you know, and then also correlated with the rule of, like, not wanting to put real people into that image. Like, he was a real person. You know, what's the designation? Is that something we maintain outside of the model? Is that something we expect the model to maintain?
It's okay if you're generating a famous person today because we know who the famous person is. But if you're doing a generic person, we don't want you to be specific. Yeah, it's a hard...
Like, it's these things are, you know, like people, it's really easy to poo-poo on Gemini and that. But these things are actually really difficult to do. Like, everyone who listens to this podcast knows the computer does exactly what you tell it to do, which is often the wrong thing.
Yep.
And, you know, like it's, you know, that distinction between, you know, is Adolf worse off than Elon? Like, yeah, what, I don't mind it having an answer for that question, but what is the impact of that to the logic? What else can it now make a very firm opinion about, and what impact is that going to have? And so it's like, it seems like a very clear design choice that they walked all the way up to the line of explaining the logic of what they would, why they would make a decision without going over it.
Right.
And so I'm not sure I care about that, right? Like it gave almost the answer, right? The direct answer.
Yeah, I mean, like I read through it and I'm like, well, I mean, me with normal morals and, you know, morality and understanding of human nature, I can very clearly tell by reading these two statements which one is worse. Mm-hmm. Like it answered my question, if that was my question, which it was not. Mm-hmm. You know, again, it's... Yeah, there's obviously, in this case, you know, the answer is very clearly Adolf. Like, there's just no way around that. Like, I can't, unless you're a Nazi, like I said. Mm-hmm. Then maybe you argue the other way around. But, you know, there are a lot more nuanced conversations of things and people and political figures. And, you know, there's a whole spectrum. I mean, like, if it's Trump versus Biden, right? Like, do you want it to come out and say... this one is worse than that one. Yeah. Like, I don't know that that's good, because that's going to make people say he's really woke if it says Trump. Mm-hmm. And if it's Biden, they're going to be like, just the liberal people, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or, you know,
yeah.
There's no way for them to win in that conversation.
Nope. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, it's, do you need it to be that definite? Is it a sign of wokeness, or is it a sign of, you know, bad design in general, that it's not making that specific opinion, determination, or answer? Like, it's, you know, like, I don't know. That's a rough one, you know. And I imagine that is one of the safeties programmed in. Don't be firm. You know, give your reasons. Leave it ambiguous so it doesn't come to the kill all humans sort of, which is, we all know the answer to kill all humans. So like, don't tell the computers. You've seen the movies.
I've seen the movies, yeah. It doesn't go great. All right. Then just wrap this up on this little bit of thread here. So Sundar Pichai was forced to write a memo to Googlers internally. I think it leaked immediately to TechMeme, which is what happens whenever he writes something to TechMeme. So it's sort of, they have to know that's going to happen. So like, you know, these have to be heavily PR'd. But he basically writes a formal letter basically saying, I want to address the recent issues with the problematic text image response in Gemini app formerly Bard. I know some of his responses have offended our users and shown bias. To be clear, that's completely unacceptable and we got it wrong. Our teams have been working around the clock to address the issues. We're already seeing a substantial improvement on a wide range of prompts. No AI is perfect, especially at this emerging stage of the industry's development. But we know the bar is high for us and we will keep at it forever long it takes. And we'll review what happened and make sure we fix it at scale. He goes on beyond that. You can go look this up if you want to read the whole article. But, you know, it is a very early days in AI. It is the wild, wild west. I don't know that the whole model is flawed because of the wokeness of Google. I think, you know, these are lessons that everyone has to learn. I'm sure ChatGPT made similar decisions too. They're just further ahead of the game, so they didn't make those bad mistakes. But they probably have bad mistakes in their system too that will eventually be revealed to the world at some point, and people will say the same thing that, oh, ChatGPT is too woke. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course, Elon was saying Grok is the only non-woke AI out there, which,
right,
I don't know about that either.
He might have a bias. I'm not sure.
Yeah, he might. Yeah, he has his own biases. Interestingly enough, in the middle of all of this, they announced they're expanding their partnership with Reddit. And so both Reddit and Google posted basically, if you know, so if you're wondering why Gemini and Maya felt like a bunch of teenagers, or, you know, potentially was a little woke, because it's apparently using the Reddit data API in new ways for Reddit to content to be displayed across Google products by providing programmatic access to new, constantly evolving and dynamic public posts, comments, etc. on Reddit. The enhancement provides Google with an efficient and structured way to access the vast corpus of existing content on Reddit and enables Google to use the Reddit data API to improve its product and services, which train the models. In addition, Reddit will be using Vertex AI to enhance some of their capabilities on the Reddit platform. And those enhancements will come out soon. So, you know, maybe not the best choice for the timing of this particular article. Not many people have linked together to the fact, like, hey, why is Reddit a big source of data for Google that potentially is being used in AI models, and this data is being used in lots of ways. But, you know, just a little side note there, you know, maybe look at the source data you're using for your model and where it came from. Not that I think Reddit's a bad place either, but, you know, there's dark corners of Reddit that are pretty scary. So,
definitely. No, that's frightening. So it's I get it. You know, it's fun to make fun of Reddit, you know, and the content, but, you know, I think it's a good source of data. It's a big source of data. I see why it's a target. It's just sort of funny.
Yeah. It's another town hall. Twitter is a town hall. Reddit is a town hall. You know, these things exist on the internet. They're places where communities come together and those communities add value, and you want to be able to tap into that value for your AI. I get it. It's just bad timing.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't think it's horrible. Well, then one more AI thing for this week. While Gemini was dragged through the mud all week, Google also announced Gemma, a family of lightweight, state-of-the-art open models built from the same research and technology that they used to create the Gemini models. And they're pleased to share that Google Cloud customers can get started today customizing and building with Gemma models and Vertex AI and running them on GKE. Gemma models share technical and infrastructure components with Gemini, and this enables Gemma to achieve best-in-class performance for their sizes compared to other open-source models. No, sorry, open source, open models. This is a key distinction. There are two weights being released for Gemma 2B and Gemma 7B. Each size is released with pre-trained and instruction-tuned variants to enable both research and development. When you say open models, it does not mean open source, I learned. I had to go get educated on this because I was like, why would you take Gemini and then make it open source? And it was like, no, open models. And so open models are meant for R&D and development, not for... you don't get to blindly just use it in your own work, unless it's like the meta models are more open source than this would be.
That's cool, actually. I had misread a lot of this news, thinking that Gemma was the same as Gemini and it was just a different sort of flavor. So this is kind of cool to see the specifically geared towards, you know, the furthering the research and use of AI. You know.
Yeah. And our last Google story, Security Command Center Premium, Google's built-in security and risk management solution for Google Cloud, now works with your organizational policies to provide near real-time detection of changes to policies and to AI resource configurations, either of which could increase your cloud risk. And these are both generally available. Unlike legacy cloud security products that often treat AI apps like any other workload, Security Command Center includes out-of-the-box security controls that can be applied in a single click. It offers continuous monitoring to detect when Vertex AI resource configurations violate security policies. Alerts are then automatically generated when the configuration of a core AI infrastructure drifts from security best practices, such as when a newly created Vertex AI Workbench notebooks permits access via public IP addresses. Workbench instances enable file download operations, and access privileges to Vertex AI workloads are changing, which, you know, I had not considered the fact that people are treating Vertex or AI workloads as any other workload, because they are not. It's like almost as bad as an S3 bucket if it's unprotected.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first security feature specifically for protection of AI that I remember reading about. And so like, this is sort of, I think it's pretty rad to get this kind of built-in managed service. Like, it's a lot of the value of using a Hoshi provider. I would be fascinated to turn this on and play around and see what the risks and what it affects. And as, you know, as I and different engineering teams in my day job, like, play around, like, it's, it, see how it would be very helpful. Like, it, so it's kind of neat. I think it's a great thing. And I think we'll see a lot more of this, like services developed in the next few years for sure.
Yeah, it'll. I imagine the AI is going to unlock a ton of things in security for us, and also make our lives harder at the same time. Because you know, the tremendous power comes great responsibility, as Spider-Man's great uncle or uncle grandfather, you know, basically says AI is the same thing. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if other cloud providers start providing these too. I also noted this one. I was like, that's a potential reinvent prediction for sure. Some AI security tooling in Inspector. Definitely.
If not reinvent, reinforce. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right, moving on to Azure. Micro takes advantage of the new licensing from VMware. Talk about the continued partnership with Broadcom. So they apparently were part of the select few vendors who were selected to continue to be in the partner program, which makes sense because they're selling a lot of VMware. They don't quite have that license portability yet, but they do have the abundance of VMware solution innovations that they're excited to add, such as the availability of Italy, North, and UAE for VMware, as well as new features such as Azure Elastic SAN support for VMware. In addition, they do want to remind you that if you're still running Windows Server 2012, you can still run it on Azure VMware to still get support. So nice to see Azure taking advantage of everyone else's doom and gloom. Move your workloads to us, please, quickly. Save your monies.
Yeah. And still, I still find it very funny to, you know, run VMware on top of a cloud hypervisor hyperscaler. But
it makes more sense when you get into like at Amazon, you've got Nitro, right? It makes more sense when you're like, oh, okay, it's not actually on CPU virtualization. It's, you know, it's actually in hardware outside of it. And then you want to run VMware on top of that. It sort of makes more sense to me, like how that plays. But yeah, if you think about, oh, if I, you know, the early days of VMware when it was Zen, and like I'm running VMware on top of Zen, and you're like, okay, that's just turtles all the way down.
Yeah. I mean, there's also, I know, you know, especially the early customers moving into cloud, like a lot of it was that DR on demand sort of prospect, right? So being able to be motion everything into that, you know, infrastructure you just spin up when you need it. And so like, I get the play definitely in a couple of different areas. I'm sure that's still very popular. It's sort of something I haven't done in quite a while.
For sure. Well, Microsoft, we talked about a few weeks ago, their investments in Spain, but they've now told us about all their investments in the European Union. Their European data center capacity is growing with massive investments, which I assume is so they don't run into another Teams fiasco if the next pandemic hits anytime soon. In the UK, they announced $3.2 billion in investment in next-generation AI data center infrastructure. In Sweden, they're investing heavily in data center capacity that's sustainable with free air cooling, rainwater harvesting, and use of renewable diesel for backup power, and partnering with Vattenfall to deliver large-scale 24/7 energy matching solutions. And Germany is doubling their Azure capacity by early 2024, in addition to the recent Spain and Italy announcements we talked about. And Asia isn't done yet, with future expansions planned for Belgium, Denmark, Austria, Finland, and Greece. So their basic answer to limited power in certain regions of Europe and the Europe moratorium is data centers for everybody, which is one option, I guess, you go with is, you know, we'll just spread the love of our Azure cloud to every country in Europe. And then everyone can say, well, if you need more capacity, you need to talk to your local government. So that's a interesting strategy as well. Azure, good move.
I mean, also some of the environmental stuff is, you know, they're legally bound to make progress in certain areas by different infrastructure. So it's sort of like, they're not doing any of the goodness of their heart. I think it's good that they're doing it. You know, I think that's fine. It's great for the European community and people who need to run workloads in those areas. And And, you know, Microsoft gets all the benefit of saying you're doing a good thing and hopefully winning hearts and minds so the next antitrust lawsuit goes in their favor.
I don't know if that's possible, but they can definitely try.
I don't think there's enough trust they can build yet. But yeah, they try.
Never be, truly trusted. That's the problem. and then this last announcement is sort of interesting. So Azure Storage Actions, serverless storage data management is now available to you. This is a fully managed platform that helps you automate data management tasks for Azure Blob Storage and Azure Data Lake Storage. Azure Storage Actions transforms the way you manage vast data assets in your object storage and data lakes with faster time to value. Its serverless infrastructure delivers a reliable platform that scales your data management needs without provisioning or managing any resources. It also includes a no-code experience that allows you to define the conditional logic for processing objects without requiring any programming expertise. The tasks you compose can securely operate on multiple datasets that have similar requirements with just a few clicks. This first release supports cost optimization, data protection, rehydration from archive, tagging, and several other use cases with more to follow later this year. The preview allows you to run tasks either scheduled or on demand, and you can compose a condition that identifies the blob you want to operate on and the operation you want to invoke. Integrated validation makes sure you verify the condition against your production data without executing any actions, and it shows you which blobs meet conditions and what the operation taken would be. Hopefully it tells you the cost too. Tasks can be assigned to execute across any storage account in the same Microsoft Entra ID tenant, and Azure Storage Actions can also be managed programmatically using REST and the Azure SDK, as well as PowerShell, Azure CLI, and Azure Resource Manager templates. Current supported operations are setting time-based retention, managing legal holds, changing tiers, managing blob expiry, setting blob tags, and deleting or undeleting blobs. Forthcoming releases will expand support for the future with additional operation capabilities. And so I was curious about this because, I mean, sort of always had this with eventing, right? And so, yes, you did have Azure Blob already supporting eventing, and then you can, of course, build your own pipeline for events, but this is the batteries included version is how I would call it.
Well, yeah, and a lot of the other providers just do this natively in the service. They don't really sort of... So I'm trying to decide between, do I like this feature or do I hate this feature? Or is it necessary because of the way that Azure Storage works? Because on one hand, it's sort of like, I like bells and whistles. I like knobs. And I love being able to customize those workflows where, you know, in other storage providers, like you have retention, you know, and it's very binary based on that. Like, is it this many days? Is it, you know, this many days after access? You know, those types of things versus, you know, maybe you get some more flexibility and things like this. You know, legal holds, you know, for example, you know, can be very cumbersome to implement. Usually do terrible things, you know, to deal with that. So that's kind of neat. But on the other hand, it's sort of like now putting time-based retention is now this extra thing that I have to do. Like, is there an easy button, you know, where it's like, I just want everything to expire after 3 days, you know, that sort of
thing. Well, I mean, it has a no-code experience. So it sounds pretty easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was sort of like, oh, it's like a no-code solution where you drag and drop boxes of it. You know, it's just a table. You drag down the selector, like, oh, I want this thing, and then I want to do this action, but then I apply, then I want to do this thing. I sort of laughed at the no-code experience when I saw the screenshot. I was like, oh, technically you're right.
Yeah.
It's not what I would think of, but I appreciate you trying.
Yeah, no, if there weren't so many rough edges to those no-code solutions, I don't know how many I've looked into and tried to play around and really tried to come around on that code, only to find out that I can't do half the things I want to do, or they're too
limited. I mean, I think AI is the solution to low-code and no-code. I think it's going to be so much easier if you want to do that kind of stuff. Like, write me a function that does the thing. You have to say function. You'll just say, like, I want to take data from this table and I want to put it in that table and I want to convert these four fields and do this based on these rule sets, and it'd be like, okay, here's your code. So I think the era of low code, no code is now just AI code.
I think they'll slowly merge into one for sure, where, you know, they'll use the no code sort of UI and sort of user interface for a lot of the answering that's done by the AI. Here's your workflow.
Exactly. Well, I have a cloud journey series entry for you today, and it's not really, you know, for going to the cloud or how you're going to go about your journey to the cloud or trying to find information, it's to celebrate someone who has completed their journey. And, you know, it was an impressive journey they took. And I thought I'd highlight some of the details here. So this is for Sabre Corporation. This is the company that every one of you has touched and been a customer of, but never knew it.
Never knew.
So Sabre is actually the back end of pretty much the entire airline industry. So when you get your ticket issued, that is typically on a Sabre-based backend system. I think there's a few exceptions like Southwest.com. I don't think uses Sabre, but I'd be incorrect now. There's a few others that are out there that don't. But if you ever miss your flight or you're sitting there and you're talking to the person at the gate and they're typing away frantically at their green screen, that's all Sabre in the backend. Yeah, that's basically what powers all those green screens is the Sabre company and Sabre Corporation. They've been around for a very long time. They were actually founded out of, I believe, American Airlines created them, or maybe another one, I don't remember. But basically, they're based out of the Dallas area, I believe. So anyways, they had a pretty mammoth migration that they took to Google Cloud. With now 90% of their workloads now on Google Cloud, and it closed 17 data centers in the process. It's a lot of data centers. Wow. Sabre announced that this agreement with Google in 2020 to drive digital transformation. The move involved migrating data and adopting Google Cloud services, including data analytics tools, as part of their operations. The Sabre CIO, Joe DeFonso, posted on LinkedIn that the migration involved 40,000 servers, 400,000 CPUs, and 50 petabytes of storage, as well as they have now integrated over a dozen analytics platforms into Google BigQuery, creating over 50,000 containers on GKE, and created dozens of new intelligence services using Google Vertex AI. Just to give you some idea of scale, and this is a very old number, but still very impressive. In December of 2013, when they had 70 airlines and 100,000 hotels they managed, they did 85,000 data transactions every second. So I imagine in 2024, they're probably doing a lot more than that. And now they're doing it all on Google, which is pretty darn impressive.
That's very impressive. I always assumed like with the green screens and the crazy, like, sometimes it looked like ticket output would be kind of weird. Like I always assumed it was like some giant mainframe, some basement somewhere.
Yeah, I was sort of wondering what that 10% that's still in a data center is, and I was like, is that the IBM mainframes?
Maybe.
But everything around those mainframes is now in the Google Cloud. That's a very good possibility. I don't know.
There's also just that one app, and I have to never use it.
Yeah, the one thing you never can move for. It's too expensive to move because it's
too expensive and too risky. Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean this is a fantastic story just because you almost never hear the other side, right? You hear the announcement, everyone's excited right at the beginning. We're gonna do a thing. And then, you know, a lot of the follow-ups that I've seen done, or it usually is sort of they're a little lackluster because it's like we got most of the way there, but didn't quite finish it. And you know, I'd say 90% in closing 17 data centers is, you know, mission accomplished. Like, I don't think getting 100% migrated should ever be the plan. It's something me and Justin fight about all the time in our day job.
I don't disagree with you. It's the edict I've been given.
And so it's sort of this interesting, like, to see the other side of that and see just how big it is. It's pretty impressive, right? And then what astonishes me is really the short time span. That's a lot for 3 years.
They had a lot of time during COVID, I guess, to focus on their migration. I would be curious if I was going to look at the Google Next conference because I hope maybe they're doing a talk. I would hope with this kind of announcement because I will probably check that one out. I imagine there's some complexities and nuances to it that I think would be really cool. And so I am looking to see if they have that right now as we talk, but I definitely love to get more details. I'd love to talk to their CIO or CTO, and ask kind of like, what was your approach? Is it all, you know, did you start dual deploying and then you just cut over? Did you, you know, was it app by app for forever? You know, there's so many different ways you can do these things.
Did you lock all your developers in a basement and right? threaten to not feed and water them if they didn't? Like, this is impressive.
So I don't see anything jump out on the catalog that says Sabre. The only thing I see close to is Alaska Airlines doing something with generative AI. That's not the same thing. So I keep my eye out for it. Maybe we can get some inside baseball from some of our people we know at Google. All right. Well, that's a good happy news to end the show on, I think. Successful migration to Google Cloud. Congratulations. I'm very, very jealous that you guys are completely done with your migration.
Yes.
Well, as close to completely done as you guys want to be. That's the key. All right, Ryan. We'll see you next week.
All right. Bye, everybody.
And that is The Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod. So, after show, you know, I think both you and I have a very similar feeling, you know, that Kubernetes was just going to kind of go away at some point. You know, this complexity, Istio, you know, pods and servlets and all these things that are hard and complicated and requiring these, you know, platform teams, you know, that someone would figure it out. And they would figure out how to make Kubernetes easy. And it would just fade into the background, kind of like VMware did, you know, really.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was going to follow the same trajectory.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, there's happened to be an article in the newstack.io website basically talking about the exact thing. And they had a similar prediction that in 2020, they thought that Kubernetes would also disappear within a year. Now, a year was probably not my time frame, especially with you know, everything that happened with the pandemic. But they believe someone would create a service that would reduce the adjacent choices and make Kubernetes the easy default. And then 4 years later, Kubernetes is still here, more complex than ever, and proven to be a tough nut to crack. And I just looked up all the different offerings of Kubernetes you have out there in the world. So Tanzu, OpenShift, Mirantis, Rancher, Docker, Kubernetes, EKS, GKE, AKS, Elasticsys, Platform 9, Linode Kubernetes, DigitalOcean Kubernetes, Alibaba Cloud Container Services for Kubernetes, IBM Cloud Kubernetes Service. And I'm sure there's many, many more open source ones that I don't know about that I did not find in my 5 minutes of Googling. Kubernetes, of course, is one of the largest drivers now of platform engineering teams, as creating a single opinionated path for Kubernetes in your organization is one of the easy ways to massively scale. And it's one of the few areas that you actually can get to a very heavily single opinionated path, which I think is part of the reason why we haven't really seen it get to that level at the global scale. And so I ask Ryan, since 2020, we did have a global pandemic, but is there more to this? Did we miss something fundamental? Because you and I are pretty much on the same opinion that this is going to fade into the background and we're still here. So what do you think?
I mean, I try to compare it a lot to VMs and the transition that people had from running their own servers and data centers and bare metal and whatever format. And then, you know, I grew up in BSD jail land and sort of that transitioning into virtualization and full virtualization. Anyway. And that took a while, but I would say that it took 10 years tops, right? Before, you know, like it's definitely still bare metal servers, but like I think VMs are the first. So
they're choice. Definitely the dominant choice in on prem until Broadcom, and now they may not be.
Yeah, but, well, yeah.
You know, virtualization, you know, Proxmox, Hyper-V, uh-huh. You know, everyone else is now going to eat VMware shorts, basically, yeah. In the on prem side. But yeah, virtualization, you know, on prem, not to have it. Yeah, you know, I would just assume, oh, you don't have virtualization because you have Kubernetes.
Right.
But to have neither would be like crazy to me.
Crazy. Crazy talk, right? You'd laugh at that. Yeah. You'd laugh at that. And so Kubernetes hasn't had quite as much time, but it's getting there, you know, like, and I continue to be like just very shocked that this is, this hasn't been sort of taken over. I thought Tanzu was definitely going to be that play, but you know, because I'm expecting the VMware sort of move, and it has fallen flat. I never expected OpenShift to really take it. They kind of wanted to solve too many things, in my opinion. But yeah, if all these other orchestrators, which are just Kubernetes flavors, right? And it's still very much Kubernetes, all the complexity, it doesn't solve all the rough networking edge cases.
Yeah. I was thinking about this in preparation to talk to you about it, you know, I was like, well, you know, if we're still inventing paradigms, you know, in Kubernetes, then maybe it makes sense that it's so complex. And if you go back to like 2019, like Istio was new, you had a bunch of storage components tree that was new, and you know, being able to move to stateful workloads and all this stuff was coming to make, you know, connecting all this stuff easier. But like, I don't I'm not aware. I mean, this is maybe just my ignorance. So, like, you know, if I'm wrong on this, you know, please someone write into us. I don't feel like there's big building blocks still coming to Kubernetes. Like, I feel like all the big pieces are there. I think it's still a little rough around security in a couple of areas. I still think there's some opportunity there, maybe. I still think the identity layer is still totally fucked in Kubernetes. it's all there, right? And so there's all the pieces are there. You would potentially want to build something standardized and something you could kind of build out of the way. But I don't know if just companies have built, come up and tried and no one wanted it, or just it's people just want to be special. I don't know. Because like even in VMware, there was uniqueness in people's VMware infrastructure. It wasn't always easy. I mean, like it has a facade of it, but there was definitely complexity. You had different hardware vendors, you had different storage layers, you had different configurations of networking, iSCSI, Fibre Channel. I mean, like there was a lot of complexity inside of it too, but like the platform itself, once you had those things kind of handled, worked just fine, which is kind of the OpenShift play, because you're kind of getting that with their platform play where you can just go, I want a container that runs Apache, and it will spin it up and you don't really think about it too much. But like you said, OpenShift hasn't really, like, didn't really go anywhere either. So it is sort of a strange thing. I know Helm charts are kind of the big deal. But you know, I also hear from a lot of people, Helm charts are super limited. They get you started, but then when you want to get to any level of complexity, they get, you know, you hit a dead end pretty hard. So yeah, I don't know. Like, is it just a few more years away, Ryan, or do you think it's never going to happen?
I'm having a hard time believing it's going to happen, like where there's going to be sort of this, you know, cookie cutter way. And I think I'm trying to figure out why, really, at this point, were we so wrong on this? Because it's like, is it the amount of options? Is it, you know, where it was in the stack? Maybe virtualization was so far down that, of course, it became sort of this thing that you abstract away and build on.
VMware was really driven solely by infrastructure. So it's one of the differences where Kubernetes touches a lot more groups, touches development typically in your development pipeline process. It touches your infrastructure teams. It touches your cloud teams. And maybe that's part of it, that everyone has a different opinion and no one can agree on those four pillars.
Yeah, because you think about virtualization, like who did it pay out for on the biggest? And it's, you know, it's those infrastructure teams that wanted to save money, but also increase their ability to serve, you know, a greater footprint. Versus Kubernetes is largely driven by developers frustrated with, slow infrastructure provisioning and complex sort of constructs at that infrastructure level. Maybe it's too many options or too many cooks in the kitchen. So you end up with, you know, six different, you know, service mesh thing solutions and nine different storage operator solutions. And maybe it's too difficult to wrangle all the different ways to sort of beat this into like a consistent mold.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Maybe we should save a little bit of this question for our co-hosts next week. Mm-hmm. Ask them if they have an idea, because I'm puzzled. It sounds like you're just as puzzled as I am.
I am just as puzzled, yeah.
So, all right. Well, we'll make them listen to what we talked about, and then maybe they'll come up with better arguments than we have. All right, and we'll table this till next week, see if they have better reasons to argue one way or another. But, the other thing I was thinking about still is I still use ECS if you gave me the choice.
I would any day. Like
any day of the week.
I don't need any of the complexity.
Yeah.
Nope. Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. All right. Well, I will let you go. Have a good weekend.
All right. You too.
Bye.